This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. If you've ever been troubled by beach pollution or a coastal oil spill, my guest, Los Angeles Times writer Kenneth Weiss, says what's happening in the deep oceans of the world will really scare you. In a five-part investigative series with co-writer Usha Lee McFarling, Weiss says humans have fundamentally altered the chemistry of the oceans, creating oxygen-deprived dead zones and spawning growths of toxic algae which spread at alarming rates. The series recently won the prestigious George Polk Award for Environmental Reporting. Weiss and McFarling are in New York for the Polk Awards, presented at a luncheon today. Well, Ken Weiss, welcome to Fresh Air. You begin this series by describing the appearance of some very troubling vegetation in the waters of Moreton Bay, Australia. Almost a science fiction-like story. Describe this weed.
It is a very strange and bizarre situation. Fishermen there have been plagued by boils and rashes that affect all parts of their body, including their private parts. And in fact, at first they didn't know what was going on, and they thought they were passing around a social disease. But over time, they figured out that it was actually connected to this black, hairy growth that they were pulling up in their nets. And no one believed them that it could possibly be so toxic until a bucket of the stuff made it back to the University of Queensland Marine Botany Laboratory. And there it got put in a seaweed dryer, and essentially the toxic fumes from the seaweed drove professors and lab techs and students streaming into the street, eyes tearing, choking, coughing. It's very caustic stuff.
So, and the fishermen get their boils from coming in contact with nets that have been in the water and that have touched this stuff?
Exactly. It turns out it's a cyanobacterium, and basically little bits and pieces of it are mixed in the water and come running down their arms, off their hands, down their arms into their clothing, and they get covered with this.
Now, this is a primordial substance, an algae, or what is it?
Yeah, this is really the primordial ooze. This is a type of cyanobacteria that used to rule the world 2.7 billion years ago. And that was a time when the oceans were a very caustic place. And these things have very good defense mechanisms and not afraid to use them. What's interesting now is that it's come back in Moreton Bay, and it's growing at an astonishing rate.
How fast can it grow?
It can basically grow about a football field an hour covering the seafloor. And so it starts off as little spores and then sprouts little tufts of black hairy weed, cover the seafloor, and then over time it creates its own oxygen, essentially, and lifts up to the surface and then is in big floating mats, sometimes the size of football fields, floating, and they end up washing ashore and driving out fish and causing general problem for fishermen.
Now, what's interesting about this series and the growth of primordial algae and microbia like this is that you're describing a kind of pollution that's different from what we typically think of, is where we dump a toxin into the water. This is actually dumping nutrients, too much food into the ocean, right?
Right. This is an issue of too much of a good thing. Nitrogen and phosphorus and iron and carbon dioxide, all things that plants and animals need for their lives. But we're stoking the oceans with sort of a daily infusion of Miracle-Gro. And there's a scientist who I think sort of sums up very succinctly what's going on here. This fellow named Jeremy Jackson at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, he says we failed to follow the basic homeowner's rule of thumb, that be careful what you dump in the swimming pool and make sure the filter is working. So if you think of the oceans as just a very big pool, we're using them as a communal toilet for sewage and runoff from farm lots and animal feedlots and a slurry of waste off city streets. And at the same time, we're stripping out all the coastal wetlands that used to take up these nutrients, and we've removed most of the oysters and clams and small fish that used to eat a lot of this algae. And the result are these prolific blooms of algae and bacteria, and many of them are toxic.
And you've seen this phenomenon all over the world, right?
It's popping up everywhere. It's quite remarkable. And so often these are reported in newspapers as local freakish phenomena. But the fact is that they are actually happening all over the world.
What is a dead zone?
A dead zone, it was a term used to describe a low oxygen area in the ocean. What happens is we have this all this nutrients washing into the ocean, creates a big bloom of algae, and as the algae dies, it sifts to the bottom. Bacteria start to break it down, and as the bacteria break down all this plant matter, it sucks all the oxygen out of the ocean. And the term dead zone is really a misnomer because there are lots of things that live in dead zones, mostly bacteria and jellyfish and a few worms. The biggest one in this country is off the coast of Louisiana, and it's been as big as the size of the state of New Jersey. Very often the dead zones have nothing in them except for this sort of white, snot-looking bacteria all over the bottom feeding on carcasses of dead crabs and anything that couldn't swim away, essentially.
So you have, an area of the ocean the size of New Jersey in which there are no swimming fish?
That's right. Dead zones are generally on the bottom of the ocean, so sometimes fish can live on the top.
Are they spreading? Are we seeing more of them?
Yeah, I think, you know, many people are aware of the dead zone off Louisiana, but scientists have been tallying these around the globe, and now there are about 150 of these dead zones throughout the world. They seem to be doubling in size and number about every decade.
What's the effect on the kinds of marine life that flourish in this chemically altered ocean?
What scientists have really noticed is that marine mammals in particular are taking it on the chin. I noticed there were stories out of Florida just this week about manatees washing ashore dead from a red tide down there. And on this coast off California, every spring we get hundreds and sometimes thousands of sea lions and birds that wash ashore either dead or dazed and confused on the beaches. And they've basically been poisoned by a neurotoxin that is produced by an algae. And they pick up this neurotoxin by eating sardines or anchovies that consume the algae and pass it up the food chain. And this stuff's really insidious, and it attacks the memory centers of the brain. And the result is bizarre. Sea lions lose their way. They swim inland up rivers and drainage ditches and as far inland as Sacramento. And others tend to turn on their young. There was an amazing incident here last year when marine mammal workers came to a rehab center and found a sea lion pup, shredded in its cage. And initially they thought vandals had come in, and only later realized that the mother had done this to her own young. The theory is that she had simply forgotten she had given birth, and when the pup tried to suckle, it ripped it apart.
And that's from a toxin they get from this algae that blooms in this nutrient-rich ocean.
That's right. This one is called Pseudonychia, and again, it seems to have a defense mechanism that can be very powerful, a neurotoxin that affects the hippocampus. It's basically the memory center of the brain.
Now, how does overfishing fit in? We've got nutrients dumping into the ocean, which tends to feed lots of microbial growth. What about the big fish, the tuna, the salmon, other big fish?
Yeah. Well, it turns out that an awful lot of the big fish have been taken from the oceans, and you've probably seen reports of 90% of the big fish are gone and predictions of collapses of seafood. But what basically happens, if you think about this as an energy cycle, we're stuffing the oceans with all this food, all this energy. And typically, you know, algae would produce, then it would get eaten by smaller fish, that would get eaten by bigger fish and work their way up the food chain. Well, we've taken out a lot of the bigger fish. So what happens is that this energy, if you will, gets cycled into what scientists call a microbial loop. So you have a profusion of algae and bacteria, and it is not taken up the food chain, so it just stays in these sort of lower rungs.
And I think one scientist said we're working our way down the evolutionary ladder.
Yeah, I think the one concern is that sort of evolution in reverse. I mean, this is the way the seas used to look billions of years ago. It was all bacteria and then later algae and then producing more advanced forms of life. These more advanced forms now are in retreat, and these other kinds of more primitive forms, they're very well adapted for change. And if they see a niche, they'll take it.
You write that jellyfish may be playing a more prominent role in the planet than in the past. Why?
Well, again, jellyfish have been around for hundreds of millions of years, and they seem to be very good at adapting and exploiting any kind of niche that opens up. So the sea turtles that eat jellies have been decimated. And there's lots and lots of things for jellyfish to eat, plankton, and basically algae. And so they've got lots of food and fewer predators, and they're moving in a big way.
And are they edible? Are we going to see more jellyfish dishes on menus 20 years from now?
Well, one of the fun things we did was we went out with a shrimper off of Georgia, and he's found he can make more money catching jellyfish than shrimp. And the reason is that shrimp have become quite scarce, and jellyfish have moved in a big way. And so one day we went out and caught tens of thousands of pounds of jellyfish, and those are processed right there in Darien, Georgia, and then shipped straight to China. And jellyfish salad and jellyfish soup is considered a delicacy in China and in Japan.
You describe some waterfowl in the Midway Atoll, an island far from just about anywhere in the Pacific, which were dying because of plastic stuff in their stomachs. Where did it come from?
The issue of plastic marine debris is starting to become a hot topic. What makes plastic so useful for you and me, it's lightweight and durable and doesn't break down, makes it persist forever, virtually forever in the environment, particularly in the oceans. The plastic that we saw out in Midway was most of it was from land-based sources. About four-fifths comes from the land. The other is jettisoned from boats. And the atolls out there act like basically giant combs in the middle of the Pacific and pick up this debris that's swirling around riding the currents. What we looked at out there were the albatross, and this is Midway Atoll where we were, which is about as far from any continent as you can get. I have to say, one of the most magical places I've ever been. It's exhilarating because there's so much life, about 2 million nesting seabirds. And it's also depressing because you see so much death. And what you see is you get to this island, and it's every square inch seems to be covered with some sort of Laysan albatross chick. And they're really sort of ridiculous in their appearance. They're about the size of a big chicken. And when we were there, they still have this downy fuzz over their face that made them look like they had a pompadour, like a bad Elvis impersonator. And you come up to them, and they start clacking their beaks as if to defend their turf. And they're quite adorable just when you see them like this, really sort of goofy birds. But then come back a few hours later, and their wings are drooped, and they're listless, and then the next day they're dead. And a wildlife biologist there, he showed us what was going on, and he would cut open the stomach of these birds, and in there would be 6 ounces or so of plastic, Lego toys, toothbrushes, toy soldiers, fishing lures, you name it. And the concern is that so much, they have so much plastic in their bellies that they're displacing the food and water they need to survive.
You write that some of the plastic takes the form of these little pellets called nurdles. What are they?
Yeah. Nurdles are essentially pre-production pellets. They're resin pellets. And these are fashioned out of petrochemicals, and they're the basic building block for all kinds of plastic materials. So these pellets are shipped from Houston and other petrochemical centers to industrial sites all over the country. And they flow like water, essentially, and then they're put into plastic molds and film extruders and this sort of thing and make everything from plastic bags to medical devices to water bottles, you name it. What happens is some of these plastic pellets spill off of manufacturing lots, out of rail yards, and they basically get washed down streams and rivers out to sea. And again, they've been found all over the world. There's a scientist in Japan who's now studying their movement around the world. He likes them because these pellets soak up toxins like DDT and PCBs. And he has a program where people mail in these little pellets to him, and he can tell how much pollutants are in their area.
So they're sort of research vessels of a sort. Huh?
Yeah. They become little research sponges that circumnavigate the globe.
You know, in one of your more recent pieces, you look at what can be done to stop the flow of nutrients into the ocean, which is creating too much food for this microbial growth and altering the chemical balance there. What sort of technologies exist, or what methods exist for limiting all this extra food we're dumping into the ocean, and where are we seeing it implemented?
Well, there are a lot of technological fixes we can make to lessen the amount of nutrients we flush into the oceans. Our sewage systems, for the most part, are fairly antiquated. There's a lot of technology out there that, we could clean our wastewater to the level that we could drink it if we wanted to spend the money. That doesn't happen very often. Usually we still use pipes flowing out to the ocean as a way to jettison this stuff and hope it stays out of sight and out of mind.
I would have thought that most sewage in the United States is pretty treated, and that the days that in which raw sewage was dumped into the ocean were long gone. Are we talking about stormwater runoff that's polluted, or are we talking about sewage that is inadequately treated, or both?
Both, actually. If you look at sewage, it's true we have improved our sewage treatment. We've knocked down the bacteria, the harmful bacteria counts that could affect someone swimming in that water. But we do almost nothing to take out the nitrogen and the phosphorus, the food essentially that causes these algae blooms.
So the stuff that we would consider clean isn't good for the ocean.
That's right. It's still stoking the oceans with too much of a good thing, too much nitrogen, too much phosphorus, too much iron, all sorts of food that causes these blooms of algae.
So much attention has been paid to global warming, with Al Gore's movie and a lot of activism. What are the stakes here in terms of the chemical changes in the ocean? Are we talking about changes of diet and loss of recreation, or something far more serious?
Well, if you're talking about global warming, the oceans are the great equalizer for our climate. The oceans cover 71% of the planet, and they absorb basically half the CO2 that we're pumping into the atmosphere through tailpipes and smokestacks. There is a cost for the ocean absorbing all this CO2. It's actually causing a chemical change. They're becoming more acidic. And the question is, why would we care? And the problem is that every clam and oyster and coral animal relies on an alkaline ocean to pull out the building blocks, the calcium carbonates they use to build their shells. So what's going to happen and predicted by the end of the century is they simply become acidic enough that they won't have this basic material to build their homes. This hasn't happened yet. But in lab experiments, they've seen little snails essentially dissolve before their eyes, upping the level of CO2 that we're going to be seeing by the end of the century.
Are there practical things that ordinary folks can do that will make a difference?
Yeah, I think there are lots of things. And I think it's not necessarily having to give up a whole lot of things, but simply make wise choices. So, for instance, I love seafood and I love to eat fish, but I'm careful to eat fish that are in pretty good shape. Their populations are in good shape instead of those who are on the brink of joining an endangered species list. One interesting rule of thumb is to try to eat lower on the food chain. So oysters and clams and mussels and small fish like herring and sardines, they have an ability to reproduce very quickly and bounce back very quickly. That's very different than the top predators such as sharks and swordfish and bluefin tuna that take many years to become mature, and taking one of those out of the ocean has a much bigger impact than these fast-producing fish. I think a lot of people are aware of these campaigns to not to litter and not to wash your car and let the suds run down the street into the storm drain, not to dump oil into the storm drain, all these sorts of things. But I think ultimately there's only so much we can do as individuals. I think it's important that we participate, but ultimately it's going to be up to governments to make big changes.
Well, Ken Weiss, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Los Angeles Times writer Ken Weiss. His series with Usha Lee McFarling, Altered Oceans, has won the prestigious George Polk Award. You can find the link to the series on our website, freshair.npr.org.